Welcome to Measured in Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. Her name is Vivian Yu.
And his name is John Julius.
She's a civil engineer.
And he's married to one.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument. Maybe it's ancient, or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about where it is, what it is, how it was built, who built it, when it was built. Is that it?
It's not that easy.
You make it look so easy,
I
John.
I make it look so easy. Stumble over it every 2 weeks.
So, thought we switch it up today.
This is our final episode of the season before we go on hiatus.
No, this is our penultimate.
This is our penultimate. Same topic, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a two-parter. Buckle up.
So part one of two.
Yeah. And unfortunately, our topic this week and next week is not that interesting.
Oh, shh. We have done an entire season of civil engineering monuments, and this is our first bridge.
And Vivian, why don't you explain to us why we haven't done bridges yet?
Because bridges keep me up at night.
It's a very complicated thing.
That could kill people.
Yes.
What do engineers hate? Doing things that could kill people. That's why do you think I do drainage? Literally no one. Well, no.
Yeah. As we've discussed, actually a lot of people, well, proper drainage saved a lot of people.
Yeah. It's easy to build drainage that doesn't kill people. Okay. Okay. Enough of a diversion.
Yes.
Part
one of two, talking about
the Brooklyn Bridge.
The Bridge of Brooklyn.
All right. It is a very iconic bridge.
For some reason.
Because it looks nice.
It looks okay.
It's usually because it looks nice.
Yeah, but we've seen it up close. It's not that great.
No, it's pretty great.
Just kidding. I love it. I saw it for the first time and I was just like, damn, that's the Brooklyn Bridge. And then also,
I think it wasn't actually. I think you looked at another bridge and you were like, damn, that's the Brooklyn Bridge. And I was like, no, John, that's something else.
That's the Brooklyn. Yeah. Anyway, I don't know my bridges. Anyhow, everything about Brooklyn impressed me because it's one of the few places that is portrayed on television and it's exactly the same when you actually go there. You had like the wrought iron fire escapes. Everybody had like the same accent. Everybody talked the same.
You had the diner.
The diner. You had the delicatessens. You had the pizza places. Like, I was very impressed with Brooklyn. And the bridge was okay. I'm just giving it a hard time.
All right. So the Brooklyn Bridge was the first bridge to span the East River connecting Manhattan to Brooklyn. It's a hybrid cable-stayed bridge / suspension bridge.
Okay.
So it has both.
Okay.
You don't know what that means.
I know what a suspension bridge is. So the bridge types is what, 8th grade science class, you learn the physics behind each type of bridge. Nah. I'm assuming that they had good reasons to do a hybrid bridge, a high bridge.
Well, the reason was mostly because suspension bridges at that time that it was built was basically in the 1850s was when it was planned. So in that time, suspension bridges were still fairly new.
Okay.
When it was built, it was the longest suspension bridge for its span.
Oh.
And so this was basically a factor of safety.
Cool. Okay.
So a suspension bridge is a bridge where you have the cable hung from the two towers on either end of the span, being the portion of the bridge that's spanning over whatever it's trying to bridge over.
The part of the bridge that's actually the bridge part.
Well, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've got a cable that hangs between the two towers, and then there are other cables connecting that cable to the bridge deck. So you're going to see this arch between the two towers, and then you're going to have the vertical cables hanging down from that line to the bridge deck, right?
Yes. Yeah.
We can all picture it.
Yeah. And also you can go onto our social media and there's going to be a photo.
Yes.
Yes.
So it's kind of difficult to see up close on the Brooklyn Bridge because it also has cable stayed bridges. So you're going to see just a lot of lines. It's hard to pick out which one's which. But the cable stayed part is where instead of having a line that's suspended from the two towers and then connected to the bridge, you're connecting directly diagonally from the tower to the bridge deck. So you can imagine a lot of basically triangles.
Yeah.
So that's what a cable stay means. It means that the bridge deck segment is directly connected to the tower itself. It right. doesn't have the suspension cable part.
Okay. And also, I think that it's a much nicer looking bridge, to be honest with you.
The because cable stay.
Because you have all the triangles and everything. It's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cleaner.
Yeah, I like it.
I mean, there are different reasons for either. I think a suspension bridge ultimately can span longer distances just because you're having the load come vertically off of a cable.
Okay.
And if you can imagine that suspension cable that's hung from the two towers, it also has a counterbalance on the other side.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So that your tower is not being just like pulled towards the middle.
Okay.
Right? That makes sense?
Yeah, vaguely.
All right. So it's a hybrid of those two styles of bridges. The two towers are built in a neo-Gothic style. So it's, you know, got masonry, it's got iron, it's
yeah, yeah.
Gothic looking.
Yeah, it's got the gargoyles.
Yeah, it's what makes it look like Batman.
Yeah, and it's also got like the, I'm sure that there's some bodies in the bridge.
Sure, probably.
Probably.
Yeah, this is how you make a good bridge. No, in. That's the, totally false.
Yeah.
It's how you poorly make a bridge.
Yeah, Vivian's worried about killing people with the bridge. She's not worried about killing people in the bridge.
No, I am. Like so many, we'll get into that.
Okay. Yes.
Total length of the bridge is 1.8 kilometers.
Hold up. I'm just going to stop you right there. Did people actually die building the Brooklyn Bridge?
Yes, definitely.
Well, I did not want to make light of that. And I'm sorry. I look like a jerk again. Again.
It's the first steel wire suspension bridge in the world.
Okay.
Okay. So we had just stepped into the steel age. And yeah. You know, everyone talks about the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. Like, yeah. Nobody friggin' talks about the steel age. That was new.
Well, actually, people do talk about the Steel Age in the context of like New York City and everything.
Oh, well, yeah. This is it.
Yeah.
It was constructed in 1869 to 1883, so roughly 14 years.
Pretty good.
It originally carried horse-drawn carriages.
Oh, okay.
Trolleys.
Yeah.
And an elevated pedestrian walkway.
Okay.
So if you go there now, it only carries cars, pedestrians and cyclists. So they've gotten rid of that public transit aspect.
Right.
It used to have trains.
Okay. But it still does like probably buses, right?
Well, yeah. But it doesn't have that dedicated transit lane right. or that transit way.
But it also doesn't need it, correct? Because of the New York City subway.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Okay. Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. So much foreshadowing.
Well, no, we'll talk about that now. Do you remember when we went to Brooklyn and we took the train into New York, it was that subway. We had to go all the way up the coastline, up the edge of New York to go across, right?
Yeah.
That was not the Brooklyn Bridge that we crossed. The Brooklyn Bridge was much closer to the lower side of Manhattan.
Oh.
So if there was a transit link there, you would be able to transport more people than you would with passenger vehicles, as you always would.
Yeah.
Public transit always transports more people. And so it's a major criticism of the fact that we've adjusted this bridge to remove the transit elements.
Oh, okay. There you go. Because I thought that it was really kind of fine taking the subway. I was impressed. We live in Toronto where we have a good bus system, but our subway covers actually a very small portion of the greater Toronto area.
Yeah.
And as opposed to New York where it's, anyway, I was impressed.
There are still, you know, dark spots.
Yeah.
In New York, naturally.
But comparatively, it's.
Yeah. So anyway, 1964, it was deemed a National Historic Civil Engineering Landmark, deemed by the American Society of Civil Engineers. Obviously, okay. A very iconic monument.
Yeah.
Brooklyn Bridge.
The Brooklyn Bridge.
So we'll get into the history of how it was built. So So the history of the Brooklyn Bridge. Let me set the scene. There was no other crossing from Manhattan to Brooklyn at the time. So commuters had to commute by ferry.
Okay.
And the reason why there was no crossing was because the East River was one of the busiest stretches of navigable salt water on Earth. And so any bridge that would cross it had to be a single span. There could not have any piers in the middle. It could not be too low. It had to be high enough. Technologically speaking, they just weren't there to build such a bridge.
Okay.
So in 1867, the government drafted a charter authorizing a private company to build and operate a bridge across the East River.
Nice.
So very much like a P3 that you would have today.
Yeah. And so I think that we've probably explained this in another episode, but a P3 is...
a public-private partnership. It's when a public entity like a government would try to get a private entity to build and operate the bridge and then in effect pay it payments. Instead of a one-time capital payment at the beginning, it would give it maybe payments over 30 years, kind of like a mortgage of a house. But that private entity would not just build it, but it will maintain it. It will operate it for that 30 years.
After that initial phase, the P3, the infrastructure then belongs to the government?
So after the 30 years, yes, there would be clauses in the contract that it would go back to the government.
Gotcha.
And so there's a lot of misconception about what P3s are. It is not the privatization of the infrastructure. It's a partnership.
Gotcha.
Right? It eventually will go back to the public side.
Gotcha. Okay.
So part of the reason why this is like a P3 is that in this sort of arrangement, the public wants to basically have the private industry solve a problem. And that's it. It's very little about like the specifics of we want it to look like this and we want it to do this and we want it to be exactly this, built like this with this material. It's very much, we just want to be able to cross this river without getting wet.
Sure.
That's it. Yeah. Right? So that's what they did. This charter didn't state what kind of structure they wanted. It said it should be a toll bridge.
Okay.
But then didn't say what type.
A tall bridge or a toll bridge?
Toll bridge.
Okay. So they wanted people to pay.
Yes.
But it would cost you less to drive there than to take a ferry probably.
Right.
Okay.
And so the government would fund the majority of the construction of the bridge, but the toll would go either directly to the private entity that built it or shared. Right. So the idea was that, you know, both the private and the public industry would have a responsibility in building and maintaining and operating this bridge.
Okay.
So this charter came out and it said it had to be completed by 1870. So this charter came out 1867. Ooh. So it said you need to build it within 3 years. A little ambitious.
A little bit.
Enter John Roebling.
Okay.
Our first hero of this story.
Is he a real hero or is he a murderer?
He's a real hero. He's a real, like, true grit kind of hero, though.
Okay.
Clint Eastwood would play John Roebling.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Like a scary Clint Eastwood. Like Clint Eastwood today.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood, like, post-chair interview thing.
would play John Roebling.
And he's our hero. Okay.
So when this came out, he was 63.
Okay, 2 years away from retirement.
He was a man of strong morals, incredibly hardworking, never took a day off. He once snapped a donkey's neck because he thought it was just faffing about.
He's our hero.
Yes.
Okay. Clint Eastwood, post, weird. Okay, good to know.
He was brilliant. He was a brilliant engineer. He was born in Germany.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And he was not a self-taught engineer, which for the mid-1800s...
pretty good.
Pretty good, right? All our previous heroes from that era, self-taught. He was not. His mother scraped and saved all the money she had to send John to the famous Polytechnic Institute in Berlin to study architecture, bridge construction, and hydraulics.
Nice.
So he worked for a little while in Europe after he graduated, and then he emigrated to America to start his colony, which became a town and is now a borough in Pennsylvania.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's a lot there.
Yeah. So he's that kind of dude.
Yeah. All right. Pennsylvania. Okay. All right. Good to know. snapped a donkey's neck because he thought it was being lazy.
Yeah.
He's our hero.
Once he was in America, basically just wanted to farm. He just wanted to farm and build this town, but he got bored.
Right.
So he decided to start engineering again. And he noticed that there were these canal boat lifts in the area. So these canal boat lifts basically were like funiculars for boats. They would hook a boat.
Yeah.
And then lift it to the canal level.
So
like a boat elevator, but literally.
We're talking about the part of a roller coaster.
Yeah.
The boring part of the roller coaster.
Yeah.
None of the excitement of the drop that follows it.
Right.
He noticed it and he says, this could be so much more exciting.
Well, it was so much more exciting because at the time, those things were operated by hemp ropes. And so they would rot with the water and the boats would come crashing down all the time.
Oh, and then he said, what if?
What if you didn't use hemp?
Oh.
So he started using iron rope.
Okay.
That he manufactured, that he invented and manufactured. So he took strands of iron and wove them together like a rope to make these iron cables. And this was the start of his company.
Okay.
And iron cables, eventually he would manufacture steel cables, which would ultimately be his key to success in building the Brooklyn Bridge, because that's what he founded the basis of his design on.
Okay. Okay. That is pretty cool, despite my
mockery.
I was very careful not to mock. I'm just like, we've had some dubious heroes on this show. And I asked if this guy was dubious. And you're like, no, he wasn't dubious. He just had a violent temper and unrealistic work ethic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
He was a fine engineer. Anyway, within 1 month of that charter becoming law, John Roebling was named the engineer for the work.
Okay.
Now, there was a lot of skepticism about this.
Because he was an older guy.
He was an older dude. They don't know why, for something so big, they named one guy to be the chief engineer.
Also valid criticism.
And within several months, John Roebling had this master plan presented for how he was going to build this bridge. He already had the design. It was just, people were skeptical. Not long before, there was another suspension bridge that had failed and it had crashed and just killed a lot of people. So people were saying, you can't actually span that wide of a distance. You can't put trains on there without shaking it to bits. You're not going to be able to account for the wind loads and the violent turbulence that you get on the East River. There's just no way.
Right. And then John Roebling said, actually, if we had not built that suspension bridge with hemp, then it would still be standing today.
Yeah, you know, if he had a sense of humor, I'm sure he would. So to combat that, he invited 7 renowned engineers and consultants to a page turn and critique his design. He invited them to come, look through all his plans, locked them all basically in a room for a week.
Nice.
And he answered all the questions.
I do like the vision of that. He's just like, you don't like it? Then come and prove me wrong. I can just imagine him like standing there with his arms crossed and just like that scowl, just like that old German scowl. I like it. Okay.
So within a couple of days, it was announced that all the engineers had approved the plan. Nice. And they had come around, all the skeptical engineers who said there's no way he could do it. He turned them all around.
Okay.
With this page turn. This is literally what I do now, is like clients say, oh, we don't like your design. All right. We're all getting locked in a room.
Yeah.
We're going to go through this until everyone's happy.
Although I imagine that when you convince people that your designs are right, you use a lot fewer like whips.
Well, most of the time.
Oh, yuck.
Okay. So that's fine. Right? The industry has basically approved his design, but the government basically still wanted a final say. So there was a congressional review being done by the chief of the Army Engineers, because back then the government's highest arm of engineering was basically the Army Engineers.
Okay.
That was going to take forever because, like, you know, the industry can review a plan in a week, but government's going to take just forever. Yeah. That never changes.
Yeah, even back then.
So what were they going to do while this was under review? Well, they thought it would be great if we just organize a tour to visit all of Roebling's biggest, most iconic previous bridges.
Okay.
21 gentlemen and one lady formed the bridge party. And they went on a tour by train of four of Roebling's bridges.
Okay.
In Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and Niagara Falls.
Oh, nice. Okay. So he's been around that region.
Yeah. And he had it all planned out, you know, which would come first and why. Ones that highlighted his architectural aesthetic capabilities. Ones that highlighted his ambitions of spanning great spans. Ones that highlighted the use of iron ropes and iron cables.
Nice.
And they were thoroughly impressed. Just this, you know, forget resumes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Let's just go look at them.
Yeah. When you think about it, to go to Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and Niagara Falls, on a map, those cities are close. In real life, that's a long drive. And they were probably on horseback, right?
No, they were on train. So they had first class train service, first class accommodations. It was a party.
Nice. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So quite nice.
Swank.
And then the plans were approved.
Of course.
All good.
Yeah.
John Roebling did not skip a beat. He was immediately on site to start surveying the ends of the bridge, trying to figure out exactly where the bridge would land on either side.
Yeah.
Because he obviously wanted to connect the streets to the bridge.
Yeah, yeah.
So he had to survey it. And he was out standing on top of a cluster of piles. Piles being kind of those like wooden poles that kind of stick out from the piers sometimes.
Yeah, we talked about piles on the Kansai Airport episode. I think
so. Yeah.
Sounds right.
So it was near the ferry slip where the ferry comes in. And he was just balancing on some pieces of wood, basically. And he noticed that the ferry was coming into dock. So he kind of started to move back, but he slipped, right? Keep in mind, the guy was 63. Yeah. So he slipped and the ferry crushed his right foot and toes.
Okay. Wow.
But he went on shouting directions to finish up the survey, fixing the locations of the bridge points before just completely collapsing.
Yeah. Okay.
So his son was with him at the time, along with another surveyor, and they carried him back, found a doctor. The doctor told him, your toes are going to have to be amputated.
Sure.
And Roebling said, fine, but I want it done without anesthetics.
Yeah. Okay.
And afterwards, he bound the wound himself in his own fashion.
Yep.
He believed at the time in hydrotherapy, which is the practice of healing by soaking something in water.
Uh-huh.
And so he just poured cold water on his foot day and night. Obviously, thing got infected.
Yeah.
There was gangrene. It started to rot. He became delirious, had seizures. He was bedridden, but still barking out orders and directions on the construction of the bridge, sending directions and sketches to site. He died within 28 days.
That is so frustrating. That is so frustrating. This guy, no. I don't know what you like about this guy. He had a violent temper. He was unbelievably stubborn. He believed in crazy stuff.
But he was a great engineer and he just had true grit. Like he believed in like building sturdy things.
But okay, fine. But that is stupid grit.
Yes.
That is pointless grit. I love his bridge. And I'm sure if I looked at the other ones, but no, this guy is at the top of our list of dubious heroes.
Well, I said he's our first hero of the story. I didn't say he's the best hero of
our
story.
I know that. He's a dubious hero. He's our first hero and he's the dubious hero.
You're not going to like this part. So when he passed away, his will, at the time, of course, he had made tons of money, right? He was already a famous engineer building famous bridges. He had a thriving industry of steel rope manufacturing.
Yeah.
So he had a small fortune. And he basically divided up his estate between his wife and his children.
Uh-huh.
For all of his children, who were all grown, He had kept a ledger of every time he lent them money as adults, down to the penny.
Nice.
And so his estate was divided between them, subtract the amounts that he had funded them as adults.
That is hilarious. Well, when you were 2 years old, I bought you candy.
No, it was as adults.
Accounting for
as
inflation.
Adults.
Accounting for inflation, that candy is worth $400. Right?
He was a difficult father, definitely.
Yeah, he was a difficult person.
After he passed away, his oldest son, Washington Roebling, took over as the chief engineer. And you're going to like him so much better.
Okay.
Okay? So Washington Roebling grew up with John as his father.
Yes.
Right? So this kid has already survived a lot, I would
survived,
say.
Survived, yeah. Okay.
At the age of 17, he was sent to study at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York.
Okay. That's how it's pronounced.
Yes.
Don't ask anyone. That's how it's pronounced.
Anyway, at 17, he was sent to engineering school.
Yes.
And it was tough. Like, I thought engineering school was tough when I went through it. 65 students started when he started.
Yeah.
12 finished. And there was one suicide.
Okay. Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a lot.
Yeah, that is a tough curriculum.
Yep.
And that was, a whole lot. But he did graduate as a civil engineer and he went directly to work for his father as a bridge builder.
Okay.
One night, this might be obvious to all the Americans, but like certainly wasn't obvious to me as a Canadian, but in the mid-1800s was the time of the Civil War.
Yeah, that should be obvious to you as a Canadian.
I don't know when these things happen. Anyway, so one night, Lincoln gave a speech of some sort and his father was listening to it.
Okay, a speech of some sort.
A speech of some sort. And his father said, "Don't you think you have stretched your legs under my mahogany long enough?" And then the next day, Washington went and enlisted for the war.
Huh.
So that's the kind of son he was.
Yeah. Please, please, Dad, just like me.
Just like me.
And the joke is that your dad is never going to like you.
No, I'm
because he doesn't like himself.
Anyway, Washington enlisted during the Civil War, rose to be an officer, and he actually built lots of bridges during that war.
Yeah.
He rose up the ranks very quickly. He was said to provide gallant service and became a colonel. So his nickname on site was Colonel Roebling.
Okay.
He once started to build a bridge over the Shenandoah.
Yeah.
And because there wasn't a boat to get across to get the measurements and to get that first line across, he just like grabbed the tape between his teeth and like jumped into the river and swam across. Hmm. So like he had grit like his father.
Yeah.
During the war, his father did start to feel a little bit bad.
Right.
And afterwards, when it was all said and done, his father affectionately welcomed him back, gave him the run of the family business, and then sent him and his young wife to Europe for a year to study how pneumonic caissons, which I will get to,
okay,
are constructed in Europe.
Interesting. Well, there you go.
Washington basically had the work ethic of John, but like a sense of humor,
yeah,
a personality. He was actually like humble.
Yeah.
You know, he always thought, oh, I'm never as brilliant as my father. But like what he did know, he had a lot of confidence in. Everyone loved working for him. So okay. When he took over the work after his father died, people really supported him. He was young. He was 32. But no one had worked closer with his father on the design of this bridge than him.
Right.
And no one knew it as well as he did. And he had, like I said, gone to Europe to study how parts of the bridge could be built.
Yeah.
And so he was the only one in America that had that expertise to do the work.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, this guy's pretty likable.
Yes, definitely. He was technically competent, very good for details, and humbler than his father. And there was a quote in this book that I read, but in this, they were quite the same. They had an absolute total confidence in their ability to do the job at hand.
Right.
That's the kind of person you want building your bridge, right? Yeah. You don't want someone like me who's like, oh God, it's going to fall. It's going to fall. It's going to fall. It's going to fall.
Yeah. You want somebody who can take that anxiety and bottle it up.
And be like, this bridge will never fall.
Yes. I'm a mediocre white man. My work is perfect.
not to get too political.
Not to get too political.
So, pressurized caissons. This is the stuff that he was sent to Europe to study.
Yeah.
Okay. A pressurized caisson is a way of constructing the foundation for a bridge pier underwater.
Okay.
So obviously the Brooklyn Bridge had two towers that were on either side of the river.
Yes.
And they were basically at the edge of the river, right? So they were underwater.
Yes.
Your riverbeds, they tend to not be very stable, right? It's muddy. It's not firm ground. So you do have to get way down into like rock.
Okay.
So how do you dig under that far to construct a foundation? Well, a pressurized caisson is basically a box without a bottom that you put on top. So you would float it like a ship.
Okay.
And then you would start to sink it to the bottom of the riverbed.
Yeah.
The air in that upside down box is now trapped and pressurized.
Oh, clever.
And this allows you to send people down into this pressurized empty box.
Yeah.
They would dig at the riverbed. And as they dug, the box would sink lower and lower. And this is how you get to the bedrock in a riverbed.
Okay, that's pretty clever. It's like a combination of a workshop and a diving bell.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like it.
And as you get to the bottom, you would fill it back up with concrete and then build a platform on top and then build your bridge pier on top of that.
Right.
So that's how you get all the way down.
Cool.
A pressurized caisson is part of the reason why so many people were injured and died during the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge.
So it's a cool idea with some flaws.
Yes. So it was invented in Europe, and that's why...
That explains it all right there.
It was invented and used in Europe at that point fairly, I wouldn't say commonly, but it was...
The Europeans used it.
Yeah. And so that's why Washington Roebling was sent to Europe to study this. It had to be watertight. It had to be pressurized water. Well, one of the biggest dangers of pressurized water and working in pressurized air underwater is decompression sickness.
Oh.
Which they did not know about at the time. So decompression sickness, if you are familiar with scuba diving, is what might be called the bends.
Yes.
And that's what happens when you are under pressurized air and you come too quickly into not pressurized air, the nitrogen in your blood become air bubbles in your bloodstream. And yes, it causes paralysis. It causes, well, first of all, aches and joint pains, but it eventually could lead to paralysis. It could lead to death. It's very severe.
Yeah.
And the problem is because of not allowing your body enough time to acclimate to each of the different pressures underwater.
I've never had it, but it seems awful.
Yes.
Just excruciating.
So the way that caissons worked, there was no easy way to transition from the different pressures.
Okay.
Right? You just had an airlock.
Oh, dear.
So in 1870, a fire broke out in one of the caissons. And Washington Roebling went into the caisson to fight the fire and to direct a fight of the fire. So Washington went in to fight this fire. He was there all day.
Yeah.
And when he came back out, he said, oh, I got some aches and pains. I don't feel quite right. But the fire wasn't completely out. So the next day, he went back in. The result of that was that he had crippling decompression sickness.
Okay.
And he was confined to his bed for the next 13 years.
13 years?
For the rest of his life, he would not be able to walk again.
Whoa. Oh, man. Bad news.
So he did direct the beginning part of this construction.
Yeah.
But once he was bound to his bed by decompression sickness, his wife, Emily Warren Roebling, our third hero of the story, stepped in.
Good for her.
And she became the eyes and ears of Washington Roebling. So Washington was still the chief engineer.
Okay. In bed.
in bed. She relayed all the information to and from Washington and the site. She reported on all of the progress.
Okay.
She was basically the field engineer. Yeah. She was the contract admin.
Yeah.
She developed extensive knowledge of strength testing, cable construction, of material testing and material properties. She took over all the day-to-day activities of the site engineer, of the chief engineer, and project management.
Yeah.
She was the one who went in front of all the politicians and all the competing engineers and defended the work every overrun.
Okay.
And when Washington's position as the chief engineer was in jeopardy, she was the one who went to defend her husband and convince all the politicians to keep the Roeblings as the prime engineer.
Right. Okay. Good for her. That is sounds like a lot of really great work.
She spent the next 13 years building that bridge.
Yeah.
Our first female engineer on
That's
the podcast.
True. Very exciting. Also kind of odd because we've jumped around. We've got some recent stuff on this podcast and this is our first female engineer.
I know. I'm so excited. Emily Roebling, guys.
Yeah. Good for her. Now, how much credit does she get? Is she kind of like third billing or is she getting her due?
So on the opening day of the bridge, she was honored. Obviously, there was a guy giving a speech of the opening, but she was particularly called out and said, "The bridge was an everlasting monument to the sacrificing devotion of a woman and her capacity for that higher education from which she has so long and too long been disbarred."
Well, that's very nice.
She went on to get a law degree.
Good for her.
And fighting for women's causes. She got a law degree from NYU. She went on to fight for women's rights. To answer your question, I don't think she's given as much credit as she is due. John Roebling and Washington Roebling are still named and noted as the engineers who built the Brooklyn Bridge. If you look up, you know, Brooklyn Bridge on a Wikipedia page or on most generic blogs or sites, they'll name John and Washington as the engineer of record, which they were.
They were the engineer of record. It's just that they were both so stubborn.
They were the designers. She was the one who sought to conclusion, to completion, to construction. She was the one who brought it from a plan to a reality. And if we compare her to all the contemporaries of everyone else that we've talked about, right? Yes, she didn't have a formal education as an engineer. But how many other engineers of the time also learned on the job, right?
A lot.
All of them were self-taught.
Yeah.
And all of them were around for the main part of the construction, for the design, to see it to fruition. And they all get credit for being the prime reason why things were built.
Yeah.
And Emily is often said to be kind of relegated almost to the administration of the work, which is, I find, very sexist. I find relevant. So let's give her the credit she's due.
Good for you, Emily Roebling. Clapping our hands silently behind the microphones.
She basically took over the work after the caissons were done, right?
Okay.
The towers were built on top. It was masonry. It was huge. It took 3 years to build. By then, the original $5 million budget was gone.
Yeah.
And they had to petition the New York State to allocate another $8 million to finish the job.
Oh, my.
And they agreed to do it, but the cities would then have all the stocks of the private shares. So at that point, the bridge became public property.
Oh, wow.
It was no longer a private venture.
Interesting.
And so that was how the Brooklyn Bridge actually got built. And I'll go into the science and innovations next episode.
Yeah.
We kind of touched on it a little bit, but there was a long history. There's three engineers to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So it made sense to split it up. And as a treat for you guys, next episode, we have a real life bridge engineer.
That's true. We do.
I'm really excited about airing that episode. Chris Mealing was a fantastic guest to have on this podcast, a fantastic first guest. And I learned so much.
Yeah.
Did you?
I did. I was there. I was quiet, but I was there, you know, learning.
Yeah. So it was really fascinating talking to a bridge engineer about how the nitty-gritty of their daily work today, what they were worried about, what keeps them up at night. Yeah, that will be our next episode. We'll pick up the innovations and the scientific parts of the Brooklyn Bridge and also how we build bridges today. So stay tuned, and I hope you guys will enjoy this two-parter. It is the finale for our first season of the podcast, and I'm so grateful for all the support that we've gotten on this podcast. I've gotten a lot of great feedback, so we need to take a little bit of a break because John and I are going to be going to the other side of the world for a little while.
Yeah, there's some work stuff going on that, well, I don't get to be a part of. I get to be a travel accessory, as is my preference.
A travel companion.
Travel companion.
I'm like Doctor Who. You're like the hot young thing that gets to
come with. That's right.
But yes, I'll be building trains in Australia for a few months. So we're going to take a little bit of a break and we'll have an episode for you guys. That's the part two of the Brooklyn Bridge. And after that, we'll see you again in season two.
Yes. Now, one thing about that, though, is we're going to be taking a break from creating new content. If you have an idea, if there's something that you would like to have us research, or if you have any feedback or anything like that, just reach out to us on social media. We're going to be around.
Yeah, we're not dead.
We're going to keep on breathing.
So thank you so much for sticking with us all season. It's been a lot of fun producing and researching all of these episodes. Subscribe and rate on whatever podcast platform you're listening to us on. And if you enjoy this podcast, please let us know and let other people around you know. It would really help us out.
Yep.
Reach out to us on social media. We're at Measured and Metric on Facebook, Measured and Metric on Instagram, and Measured and Met on Twitter. And our website is measuredandmetric.com. Special thanks to Astronomic Audio for editing and sound engineering this episode and all of our episodes. And remember, always measure and metric.
Although I imagine that this one was not measured in metric, the Brooklyn Bridge.
No, none of them were measured in metric. I just convert all of them.
Oh, man. I've been this whole time, I've been living a lie.